fourth Senate meeting of the year. You see the usual rules of the game up there on the slide. Okay, I have announced some announcements. They all revolve around one thing. Next slide, please, Jill. So many of you are, I'm sure, aware of a petition that was circulated across faculty, graduate students, and staff with a list of demands associated with developing a more anti-racist Cornell. So you can, the link is on our website. It's also there on the slide. There are close to 40 different demands. Some of them resonate very closely with our planned agenda for this fall. And I just wanted to step through four of them. Okay, so the first thing has to do with how we're going to go about thinking and developing a proposal for a center. And I wholeheartedly agree with that particular demand. And we'll talk about working group C that will be in charge of sending something to the Senate in about 2 months. And we certainly plan on staffing that working group in an intelligent way. Next. You skipped. Okay. The whole role of standardized tests has been around for quite some time, and I'm sure we're all aware of that. The university has to sort of make a decision about it, or there's a planned decision about it in early spring. And I have already talked to Vice Provost for Enrollment about this, and the plan is for him to come to the Senate and for us to get well-versed in all the different issues. So that's very much in our fall agenda plan. Next. Having a Toni Morrison Hall, in particular Goldwyn Smith. And as you know, over the last week, have all been thinking about an analogous thing for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I'll talk about the act of naming a building, renaming a building or a school or a program shortly. But that's, again, something very important to consider and highly relevant right now. Next, please. Systematic review of the curriculum. This was a request of Martha, and it's exactly the same pretty much in the petition. This is a decentralized effort. We made an attempt maybe about 3 weeks ago to plug into the colleges, and we have a web page where that's all set up. We have contacts. The colleges have sent me some things. However, it's kind of early days. What we're looking for are links to committees that are doing work so we can track them. Then I had a sort of a second thought, realizing that a lot of this work is centered in departments. And all I'm saying is it's hard to figure out what's going on, but we want to make an effort to do that. And Nima and I are planning on having some kind of Zoom forum in the next week or two, where we can actually get people who are right now engaged in that activity, figure out how they're doing it, develop principles, and share them. Okay. So. Let me just pause at this point. Does anyone have any questions they'd like to ask me about these particular sets of activities that were identified in the petition and which are very much right in our path? Okay, let's go on to the issue about how we can honor Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who died a little over a week ago. So we posted this question and circulated it on a Monday message, and we got quite a few suggestions. If you want the next slide, please. Well, actually, it's sort of a fairly short list of suggestions. So they fall into sort of different categories. So one is structures, okay, buildings, right? So Goldwyn Smith was mentioned more than any other building. Lincoln Hall, because her affection for music. Ideas about an Arts Quad statue. We're building on North Campus, that's another possibility, and Hasbrook Apartments. And there's a sort of a story behind the Hasbrook name, which you can read about on the website. And you have sort of academic unit renamings, such as the law school. Okay, of course, she was an undergraduate here, but nevertheless, that would be a relevant thing. We had all the discussion last year about developing a school for public policy. And then you have programs like FGSS. So that's another cluster of possibilities. Embedded in all this are the sort of the usual things you do, endowed professorships, special lectures, awards, scholarships, and so on. So those are sort of the things that came up. Let me talk, then I did a little bit of homework about how you pull these things off. So let's take a look at the next slide. Okay, so here are the sort of three facts, okay? So first of all, in the Alumni Affairs and Development Office is a standing committee that deals with memorials and named facilities. Okay, so there's a group that vets these things. Clearly they interact with the senior administration and also the trustees. Anyway, that's a target of where we can send something. More specific to North Campus, Vice President Lombardi is standing up a committee that he tells me will involve some of the faculty and residents up there, because there'll be, I'm not sure what the count is, a couple of buildings there, and that perhaps there's a naming opportunity. And then sort of a very kind of obvious sort of thing, which the Vice President Van Sickle, who runs the development office, told me, which is basically it's harder to raise money when the legacy in question is not the donor's legacy. Okay, so there's that sort of obvious thing. And all those things on the previous slide come with price tags. I mean, naming something like the law school, you know, you're talking about $100 million, okay? Other things are smaller. So there is that issue. And I guess this was sort of before I paid a lot of attention to these things, but I know when West Campus was built, those houses are named after, if I'm correct, sort of famous faculty and people who figure it in Cornell history. And when you do that, you can certainly inspire donors to contribute, but not quite as much as if you named a building after the donor. Okay, so that's just out there. Okay, what do we do? Okay, next slide. So, I just wanted to remind you again, in this whole space, same sorts of possibilities and interests, you know, maybe a slightly different set of possibilities, but for Toni Morrison. And I know the English department is staging a big event, I think next week. This is an ongoing and very important salutation to one of our most famous alumni. Anyway, so all this is sort of these two individuals are certainly worthy of some kind of Senate action. How can we express ourselves? So here's some possibilities, and then I'll shut up and you can talk or make suggestions. So we can do a resolution, and we can do a sense of the Senate resolution expressing how important it is we feel that there be some explicit recognition of these two individuals. We could kick it up a notch. It's not hard, but you could make a formal resolution. And then what I would do is take these and send them to both the development office and also Ryan, who's working on the North Campus thing. And that's about all we can really do. But I think it's sort of worth doing. The question is, what's the form of that resolution? I mean, you can't get too specific. Well, you know, is it Goldwyn Smith or Lincoln Hall? I don't think we have to get to that level. I think just somehow we want to express how important it is to the faculty that a step be taken in this direction. So let me pause right here and get some feedback from you. If we do the resolution, I guess I would sort of work with the UFC to put it together. We'd run it by you and we'd say vote on it at the next Senate meeting. There's no big rush. These things move at a fairly slow speed. The next Senate meeting or the one after that. Anyway, your thoughts on that, I'd be very interested to hear. Abby Cohn, one of our faculty trustees. Abby.
So one thought I have, if I understand it correctly, is this is something where we might want to make common cause with the other assemblies, with the employee and both of the student assemblies, because if all four assemblies make a resolution, it has to get put on the board agenda.
That's a really good point, Abby. I mean, just from the practical point of view, getting on the agenda, but just as a unified voice would be very good.
I think whatever we do, it would be great then for you to communicate with the assemblies and you know, because that's how the carbon neutral thing got to the board, and it had to go to the board because of that. So I think it just is a powerful statement if we raise our voice collectively.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. And we'll certainly do that. The SAE, as you know, is just getting going. The pandemic delayed elections in some of the assemblies. They're just sort of getting in gear, but we could certainly orchestrate that. It's a really good point. Additional comments or thoughts? I see Risa and then Ken's iPad, but okay, but Risa.
Yeah, thanks. I think that's a great idea that Abby put forward in terms of the coalition building. I just wanted to clarify, and you might have been clear on this, but for myself, that some sort of resolution, I think, should be both for Ruth Bader Ginsburg and for Toni Morrison, as opposed to only talking about Ginsburg. And it wasn't absolutely clear to me whether we were supporting both, and I would certainly support both.
I think both, and I think kind of a nice symmetry. I would sort of favor one resolution, but that's just my thoughts right now. Ken Berman? Ken?
There we are. I'm sorry, I had a little trouble with unmute. I would favor these resolutions. There's some discussion in chat about Goldman Smith, who apparently was a terrible anti-Semite. And I was unaware of that. Now that I'm aware of it, I very much like the idea of renaming that building.
Right. Thank you. Doug Anzac.
Considering the buildings, I think Mike Tony already sent in a note to the chat that we already have a Morrison Hall up in the Ag Quad, but we could do with another. But I'm thinking also that it's very easy for us to urge the administration to name a building after one person or another. But after that's done, it doesn't require any work from us. And it may have less lasting impact than some kind of program like a distinguished lecture. I know there's one in the Ag School for Professor Asdell, and every year we hear the history of what he contributed to Cornell. And that's more like a living document. And I think we need something like that as well.
Right. Well, buildings take you immediately to the trustee level. So would naming a school, something within a college, you know, a lecture series or scholarships and so on. Then you're at the sort of the college level. So I think for now we should focus on the stuff that might head to the trustees. But you're absolutely right that things like that you mentioned, Doug, would be very important too. Okay, seeing as there's no more discussion on that, thank you. So I think this is a worthy exercise that we'll follow up on. Okay, we're close to 100. Okay, so we likely have quorum. Okay, Jill, next slide. All right, so again, background, we have these special professorships, professor of the practice, clinical professor, research professor. Rules of the game are that when a college wants to offer such a title, they come to the Senate with a proposal. There's a template for what the proposal must cover. The Senate, after CAP weighs in, votes on it. So the situation in the business school is that with the merger of three schools, each with their own three units, each with their own POP policy, some packaging was required. And just to be clear and respectful of faculty governance, the JCB came to us with a proposal, went through CAP, they're fine with it. And now, and we talked about it 3 weeks ago, Andrew Caroldi is here to give a quick overview and then we'll lock ourselves into a vote. But the next slide, please. So we try to play ball with, next slide, Jill. We try to play ball with Robert's rules. Just to be formal here, we're now going to discuss a resolution. So can somebody just raise their hand saying that they're okay with this?
I move the resolution.
Okay, great, thanks. Next slide, Jill. And Andrew, give us a quick rundown of what you talked about 3 weeks ago, and then we can entertain questions.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, everybody. Promised less than 45 seconds here for the synopsis. As Charlie mentioned, three schools merged just under 5 years ago into one college, each with their own respective professor of practice policies. Our college faculty policy committee convened. This is our elected body within the college among faculty convened, and they wanted to advance a harmonized policy. And it came to the fore last year. We brought it before our faculty for a vote, and the vote received approval within the college among the faculty. The key features are listed there for you. Experienced non-academics who can also be outstanding specialized teachers, that there is a 25% college-wide cap, but that specific schools, one of the three schools could have more stringent caps within, and that it is made clear in the spirit of the university's guidance on this that this would not be a promotion path for senior lecturers, senior research associates, or senior extension associates, but rather it would be a reclassification exercise. There you have the votes. A question arose in the meeting we had 3 weeks ago that what are our rules within the college on quorum as I was reporting the vote to you. And as I reported to you at the time, I was not sure because in fact, it was the case that the college had not yet decided on what constitutes a quorum in its short life. As in these instances, we typically fall back to the respective three schools and their policies. Robert's Rules of Orders were the formalized policies, as one of the senators suggested. It is a two-thirds representation, and our count of the electorate implied 200. 200 would be required. That is what we met, more than met, with our electorate. So I just wanted to report that because that's a letter I sent back to Charlie in the aftermath of last week's, 3 weeks ago's meeting. I'll stop and take any questions from the senators on the policy. Yeah.
I have a question, Andrew. This is Mary McCausland. How are you?
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you for presenting this. One thing that you said was that there wasn't, a cap within each school, but rather it was 25% applied to the college. What are the current numbers in terms of how many already have that title in each school, and how are they expected to be divided?
So I can answer the first question. I'm going to give you an approximate number. It's approximately 9, and it is across two of the three schools. One of our three schools, the one you know best, the hotel school, has a 5% cap. The Johnson School had originally, when the Senate resolved to approve its policy, had a 25% cap, 25% relative to the base of tenure track. The harder question you ask is what the longer term plans are. And at this point, I can't say that our leadership has actually designed a strategy for this as part of its annual cycle of faculty authorizations, or has designed any kind of intermediate term plan for this, as far as apportioning these types of titles across the three schools. We have a mechanism by which we do that, and I don't want to bore the faculty, the senators on that matter, but I'll be happy to answer your question offline.
Okay, thank you. And I just wanted to make sure it was on the radar screen, so that all of these wouldn't go necessarily to one school or to two. That was just my only concern. Thank you.
Risa, then Richard Bensel. Risa.
Yeah, thank you. So last time I had raised the question about the rules from the enabling legislation with regard to professor of practice, and that was the professor of practice simply adopted the same enabling legislation as clinical professors. And there is the requirement in that enabling legislation that the proposal must be approved by at least 2/3 of those voting in person or by ballot in each of 2 separate votes of tenure track and of non-tenure track faculty of the originating college or school. Further, for the proposal to be approved, at least half of all those faculty members eligible to vote in each case must vote for it. And so I didn't see any more information about that other than the dean saying that you don't distinguish between the two, but the enabling legislation does distinguish.
I'm not sure. I know the vote in Andrew should speak to this. The vote in the JCB was there was no separation between the RTE vote and the TT votes.
Right, and the requirement in the enabling legislation is that it has to be done separately.
I understand. It just wasn't done that way. We didn't separate the two.
Well, then I think that this doesn't actually meet the requirements of the enabling legislation.
So your proposal then, Risa, is to not vote, to postpone this vote?
Well, I'm not really proposing anything in particular. I mean, it shouldn't really have come to us, I suppose. It seems to me that it's not ready for a vote because it hasn't met the requirements and, you know, it just slipped through without, I guess, the appropriate committees recognizing that.
I haven't, in terms of these votes, when you start from scratch, when a college proposes things, I'm not quite sure that this has ever come up, okay? I also know, for example, there are about a dozen of these out there, and there's variation, all right? So for example, like in engineering, it's 25% of the total college, all right? Other units, say 25% in each unit. Engineering conceivably could put 50 professors of the practice into a single unit. What I'm sort of saying here is that, I'm not saying loosey-goosey, but there hasn't been what I would say absolute strict following of the enabling legislation over all these proposals. I also noticed, for example, the law school has 40 tenure track faculty and 18 clinical professors. Again, that's above the 25% rule. I guess my stance here and what I'm sort of saying, and if there's agreement, we can either postpone this or go ahead. But I'm saying there's not what I would say strict following of the rules in all these things. And maybe that's a deal breaker for some people. The other point of view is whether or not the overall proposal makes academic sense, is good for the school and also for the university. So that's all I can sort of contribute here. Maybe other people should chime in on this.
Charlie, there was a
Richard Bensel had his hand up before. Richard, you want to speak? I'm not sure what you want. I'd like to stick with this sort of issue about whether or not we want to. I guess it's up to Risa if you want to have this tabled.
I'm not sure what you're saying, Charlie. I had a question, a different sort of question, but I can wait if you want to. Discuss this one. For the record, I do think holding to our regulations is a good idea, because sometimes we don't, we get in trouble. So this is something where it is, what Reese is raising could be regarded as a technicality, but the vote isn't so overwhelming that it's possible that the distribution of votes would not meet the enabling requirement. So, but I do have a question that I'd like to ask, an information question, is that appropriate now?
Yeah, let's see how long it takes to answer. Yeah.
So, well, it's a fact question. Mary asked about the number of professors of practice, and that was going to be my first question. The second question is the number of professors of practice who have doctorates, because one of the worries about professors of practice in these other kinds of categories is that we're shifting from tenure track to other kinds of informal employment of academic appointments. So the question is, how many of the professors of practice now in the have doctorates, and what does that, what is the requirement in the future? I like the document explaining the different criteria and so forth. I thought it was very clear, but it didn't answer that question.
I'm not going to be perfectly accurate, but I just went through my head with each of the nine that I have in mind. And if you include JD with PhD, I believe every single one. If JD is considered a terminal degree, the equivalent of a doctorate, then every single one of them has the equivalent of PhD.
Okay, so we have to sort of process this fairly quickly. So the question now, Risa, do you want to have a motion to table the vote on this? And then I guess we have to discuss that, and if we can quickly come to a resolution on that. Would you like to do that? Do you feel that's necessary?
Yes. And if that's the appropriate motion to table, then, you know, I don't know if we have a parliamentarian, but if that's the appropriate motion to table it, I so move.
Is it seconded?
Chris Schaefer here. I second tabling this motion until an appropriate vote that matches the enabling legislation has been reported to the Senate from the law school.
Okay. Just quick, Mike Tomlin, do you want to chair a cap? Do you have just want to make a comment?
I am glad for any clarification because CAP has wrestled with this repeatedly, and going forward, it's going to continue being an issue. So I very much appreciate any clarification that the Senate wishes to offer.
Okay, so I guess we, it's too bad I'm not a Robert's Rule guru here. I guess we vote on this. Is that right? The motion.
I have my hand up.
Yeah.
So I wanted to just speak to the issue of to discuss this. I think what I want to point out is that, you know, it's very easy to say, oh well, this is, you know, a technical issue, and why are we bothering with it. But, you know, my memory of the discussion about whether to do clinical professors originally, and now, you know, it's been extended to professors of practice, was that the separate votes were important because the, at that time, you know, the term is non-tenure track faculty, now we use RTE, that the RTE faculty may in fact have a different view of this than the tenure track and tenured faculty. And so the separate votes were quite deliberate for that reason. Both in terms of the two-thirds vote issue, and then also of those voting, two-thirds vote, and then also of the 50% of all those eligible to vote. It was quite deliberately done. It was not viewed as, oh, well, this is just technical.
Mike, Tony, do we vote on the tabling, or we just let it go and ask the JCB to come back with a redone vote? Mike? Tony?
We need to vote on the motion. Okay. It's on the floor. That's what's on the floor. And there's no debate about that motion.
Okay, so I guess on the chat, all those in favor of tabling the motion, use chat. A simple majority, Mike?
Yes.
What do we have, Jill?
Yeah, there's only, I see one abstain, one no. Everything else is coming in, yes, or supportive.
Okay, so we'll have to table this, and Andrew will have to have a discussion after this about how to proceed. So we'll have to, I guess basically the JCB will have to stage the two votes or a vote where we have the separate totals, and I'll make sure we send a clear message to you there.
Thank you, Charlie. I appreciate everybody's time. We're patient.
Okay, thanks. All right, let's go on to the next thing. Bill, okay, keep going. Okay, yeah, so we now have four things to talk about that all connect to the anti-racism initiative. So one has to do with the working groups that were forming the charges, sort of like want to make sure that everyone's okay with those charges. Then Angela Winfield will talk about a mandatory program that's come up for staff and what its relevance might be for faculty. Avery and Yale are here to talk about what we sort of currently have in the way of educational programs for faculty. And then Professor Goff from Africana has experience with the Milstein program and with humanities and tech instruction will close out the discussion here. Okay, let's get on with the working group thing. Okay, next slide. Okay, so before we, the three of them, and before we step through them, just some reminders, or maybe this is new to you, I'm not sure. This is our fifth meeting in a row where we've talked about these sorts of things. So first of all, we're talking, referring to these as working groups, not committees, okay? And they have facilitators, not chairs. The point here is that it's a very flat structure and one that's totally transparent. If you look at the last two items there, all the agendas will be published in advance. Most of the meetings will be open, but for sure, all the meetings will be recorded and posted. And then another real important detail here, this is, these working groups report to the Senate, not the administration, okay? And that means that they don't, it sort of just takes a little bit of the heat out of it. It's not the end of result of what these working groups produce. It's simply doing homework, showing up with the Senate with proposals that we will then discuss much more globally and broadly. Okay, so with those reminders, let's get on and look at these three working groups. And you know about this three-way split, okay? One has to do with the center, one has to do with students, and one has to do with faculty, okay? They're all related, okay? But we're splitting these tasks into three different groups, okay? In each of these things, so let's talk about the center. Online is the full charge, okay? And remember, charges can be modified as you go along, but they have to be good enough. So at the start, you can convince people to perhaps serve on these working group committees, and they provide enough structure so that you don't go all over the place trying to figure out what you're supposed to look into. So the first one here is really actually the most important thing across all three working groups, which is to say, there has to be a compelling vision, okay, that encompasses the whole campus, okay? That's a critical thing. We sort of know what it's about, but that has to be refined, okay? That has to be refined. And one way you do it is you sort of have to file an environmental impact statement, so to speak. What is going to be the connection between this center and nearby centers? How are they going to amplify existing strengths, okay? How are they going to support faculty and students who are doing work in this area? So that's a real important thing to consider, because there is a lot of current work on campus, a lot of it distributed across several important entities. Third, what about external visibility? To what extent will this new center help us recruit excellent faculty and students? This is a critical sort of thing. Now, in our discussions, and you and I have had quite extensive discussions across campus, there are all different models out there. And I'm not saying, we're not saying the Society of the Humanities is a good one, but it's a very, very interesting one, okay? It's highly endowed, supports faculty on campus, brings in people from the outside, supports postdocs, teaching, and it is perhaps a model that should be considered. So those are the sort of the key things that this particular working group will work on. Now, getting back to the compelling vision, just as an example, the Mellon Foundation awarded Rutgers $15 million for an institute for the study of global racial justice. Okay, now that says a couple of things. You know, the Mellon Foundation is out there and has interest in this area. You also see, and it's a nice reminder, we're using the word anti-racism as a placeholder, as indeed the word center, okay? We have centers and institutes. Whether or not anti-racism is the proper title is to be determined, okay? You know, systemic racism, global racial justice, you can see all the different factors here, and how that plays out is part of the exercise that this working group will go through. Let me just pause right here, okay, if people have particular comments they'd like to make about this. Again, when you look at these charges, you want to make sure they're flexible enough that the working group will make sure, will consider all the right things, the important things. And if something's missing, you know, we'd certainly like to hear about that. So let me again pause right here and entertain questions. So I see Peter from chemistry and then Joni from English. Peter.
You're muted.
Certainly the one thing that I would like to see in any kind of a center here is the inclusion of science in it, or because, you know, a lot of the issues that we face along these lines are significant in terms of hiring, significant in terms of students being, having a, I would say a bad, they have a bad opinion about what we're doing in regard to hiring practices and so forth, because they don't know the system. So we were talking about this today at lunch, at our faculty lunch, that, you know, what we would like to get out of any of this stuff would be definitely inclusion, and definitely opening up our hiring practices so the students could see much more openness in that regard.
I think what you just said will speak to the working group concerned with the faculty, the programs for faculty and so on. But those are very good points, Peter. Joni.
Thanks. Yeah, this is Joni Mikowski in English. And I just want to point out that to frame this anti-racism center, which is developing in consequence of the violence and the prevalent violence that can't be ignored anymore, that I sense I guess some torque in that the center that we're also framing it as in terms of our visibility and recruiting excellence in that the competition and strife and always seeking to best seem a part of the problem. And so just part of the language and the intention of demonstrating our excellence and our power, our supremacy. I wish that we're say other ways to consider what we're doing.
Well, a key thing is to identify what the research scope is of the center, and you. But don't you agree that an attribute of a center, and we have many of them on campus, is to attract, you know, elevate research on campus, and also to attract faculty and to become well known for what you're doing. I mean, isn't that?
Or finding truth, you know, or becoming well known, or. You know, framing it as a competition, or as finding answers, ways to achieve peace.
Charlie, could I just chime in for a second? Joni, I totally hear you about sort of looking at this question of excellence or recruitment as being competitive and problematic. But I think when we were writing this and when in our conversations with our colleagues, you know, the issue is also of providing a supportive environment. And so the maybe one way to think about it is the reframing of it, and then we should change the language. And so it's really about sort of this question of the politics of presence and support, right? And that faculty who engage in this work, that who engage in work that sort of decolonizes disciplines, that opens up questions of racism, that they find the kind of support and collegial spirit to be able to do their the kinds of work they want to do. So that is also part of it, and perhaps that language needs to be changed. But it's not only a framing in terms of competition or a marketplace.
Thank you.
Thank you. So let's go on to the. We have more. Risa and David Lee. Incidentally, if you you can always post comments on the Senate on the agenda page if we run out of time or whatever. Risa.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on what Joni had raised and Nima's response. I found both of them very thoughtful and important, and perhaps to insert a connector between the two. I don't think that what Nima is saying and what Joni's saying are contradictory, but perhaps a connector is that to talk about an anti-racism center and to come out of the particular moment where we are has a certain activist aspect to it. So it's supportive of all the ways in which Nima was describing, you know, supporting people's work of decolonizing and looking at racism in terms of our work, our curriculum, our research, et cetera. But there's also the engagement aspect of it, which I think is an activist notion that perhaps isn't yet captured by the language. And that may also, I think, speak to what I heard also Joni saying.
Good point. David Lee?
My point was pretty much the same as Risa's. We didn't plan this, but I guess I'm a little hung up on your point number one. In fact, the whole discussion, it seems to be we're talking about research, right? I mean, we all do research. We have centers, institutes, and programs on campus that all do research. Going back to this summer's meetings of the Senate, it seemed to me that the main thrust throughout many of those meetings was a lack of comfort with the fact that we're doing business as usual, and that there was a sense that, as Risa is suggesting, that something more engaged, more activist, whatever you want to call it, was called for. Behaviors, basically, of students, of faculty, and so forth. So I guess I think almost there's another question that really needs to be asked first, and that is the real need here for more research? I'm not convinced of that. There's a lot of research. I'm wondering if the real need here is, as Risa is suggesting, something that's more activist, something that's more behavioral change oriented toward the community. And if that's the case, I'm not sure the word center is even appropriate. It seems to me that effort or initiative or program or something that is more dynamic, more engaged is more appropriate than one more center. I think you remember the president's initial email back in July, I think listed 12 centers that are already doing related work. And I think Charlie, you had an email at one point that listed 20 centers that are doing related research. Do we really need another center? I'm not convinced of that, but I think something that's more more active, more engaged might be more appropriate.
Okay, remember we're using the word center as a placeholder. Let's go on to Peter, and then we have to get on to the next working group. Peter?
Yeah, in our faculty meeting today where we had discussions about this, the idea was brought forth that some sort of outreach would be a really critical component of the center, I would think. we're in a unique environment here, being sort of the flaming liberal spot and dot in upstate New York, and some sense of outreach, I think, from a center like this would really, I think, would be a wonderful idea, especially given the wide disparity in both education and economics that we're seeing show up and all across the country in pretty much every phase of life.
Okay, very good. Let's go on to the next working group, which is concerned with a university-wide requirement for students. Okay, so again, the number one here is sort of, you know, what's the goal? In other words, there's a high level question for all of these sorts of things. What is the goal of this requirement? And how is it different from what we already have, which is, and it varies from college to college, diversity inclusion related requirements already exist. Then there's the other sort of thing about this university requirements. You can think swim test, but maybe this is a better sort of thing. You know, just about every degree program has some kind of math or quantitative reasoning requirement. It's not a university requirement, but over the years, math has been elevated as something that's important and it shows up sort of naturally. So when you think about the trying to sell or advertise or justify an educational requirement, is there some analogy that might be in play here? Then you have the menu question at two levels. So colleges sort of control curriculum. So each college could be doing its own thing, but there might be some standard that they have to be held to. Well, what is that standard? How do you get on the, you know, how do you qualify? How does your college's program qualify? Then you have the other level of menu, which is to say, you know, here's a list of 50 courses. You can take any one of them to satisfy this requirement. So again, how do you get on the menu? Who decides? How do you maintain it? Those are some practical sorts of issues. And although the tone is sort of undergraduate, we're really talking about all students. Now, of course, it's a very different scene if you're here for 1 year as a professional master's student, or if you're here for, say, 6 years as a PhD student. In any case, that is something that should be addressed by this working group. How does the, whatever we're trying to do for undergraduates, how does it show up? How is it delivered at the graduate level? Okay, any questions about this one? Sufficiently broad for this group to run with it and make a proposal to us. Okay, third. And we'll, Angela will talk to us about this more, and actually Avery and Yale as well. So what about for faculty? Okay, so of course, anything that has the word required or mandatory or training immediately gets us on the defensive, so to speak. So the question is, we do a lot in this sort of area. Peter mentioned this sort of in his remarks a few minutes ago. There's a lot on the ground. How do we build on that? Okay, or is it something totally different that we have to build on that? And then what Angela talked to us about, a program has been developed that's required for staff. Okay, she'll tell us all about it. Is it relevant to us? Is the content relevant to us? Is the delivery mechanism something to pay attention to? Okay, and then the thing about we're all booked to the gills, right? We have no time for anything. And you get nervous about requirements. But think about, for example, department meetings. Okay, so they're kind of required. And if you could embed this educational component within a department in the meetings that are held, then you begin to see that it's sort of folded into our regular way of doing business. So anyway, that's a very hard thing we have to come to grips with, which is that we're all just so busy. How can we incorporate yet another center, yet another requirement, yet another thing on our to-do list? Anyway, it's very, very important. And all these things are highlighted not only in the, highlighted by this the Do Better Cornell and petitions that have been around now for several years from the students, that they want to see some real progress in this regard. Again, any sorts of questions, any way you can see this as being to embellish it, to make it clearer, and so on. Richard Bensel.